Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
a molecular tour of mustard gas. There's sort of certain ways into it. As you can see or would have heard, I see shapes in molecules, snowmen, giraffes. Mustard gas, for me, is like a bird, a bird of death, so to speak. I'm going to give you a podcast. The background is that I'm doing my cardiac rehabilitation walk. My memory is slowly coming back to me. I'm slowly improving on things. So it's a thing where I just have a quick look at the molecule, and I'm pretty sure I can remember the aspects of it. And so there's sort of aspects of the walking, the memory, but mustard gas. This is the gas developed in World War I by the Germans, and it's a blistering gas. Not really a gas, a fine mist. The little particles would get on you. I think the British picked it up very quickly, and I think the British started off using gas warfare. They had their gas bottles, and of course the wind was always blowing from the German side towards the Brits. So well, what happened is they'd have to launch the shells behind the Germans for it to go up. It's all pretty sad sort of stuff. And of course, the hospitals in Australia, the Rupat hospitals, were all full of gas victims. You know, this is in the 70s, there were just hospitals still full of people from the various gas attacks. But I'm up here in Glenbrook. I'll just talk a bit more about mustard gas. Glenbrook was where the British Empire stored its mustard gas for use. I don't know why they used it. It was the general storage for the mustard gas. And what happened is that there was an ideal abandoned railway tunnel which they put the mustard gas in, and there was a chemical warfare unit up here. This is during World War II, and the story is that there used to be, Glenbrook was there's an escarpment. So Glenbrook's in the last, Glenbrook's in New South Wales, in Australia, sort of middle of Australia, on the east coast of Australia, around Sydney. Sydney's relatively flat, and then you have a sudden rise from 30 metres above sea level to 330 metres above sea level in about a kilometre or so. It's a bigger escarpment, and that hemmed in, thankfully, white expansion for a fair while. And this area meant that they had to get the railway up it, and so there was a big zigzag up the front. So they'd get a grade, go up the hill, stop the train, zag it the other way, and gradually work their way up the escarpment, and then it would come around and go through a tunnel. So the centre part where I'm actually walking past was a large tunnel, and you actually walk over this tunnel here. You actually walk into the bush, and you see a ravine, and the gates, the tunnels have these big iron gates over it. So there was so it was an ideal place, sourcing an abandoned tunnel. Now, what actually happened the tunnel was too long and too thin, so the actual steam engines going through the tunnel would run out of oxygen and all stall. I don't know how the passengers survived, but it was a tough tunnel. It wasn't liked, and then there was a dreadful accident where a train got out of control from the zigzag and went down, and there was a lot of deaths and fatalities. This is before the World War I, and the like, and this train fell out, and they buried the bodies where the train derailed at the end, and that became a Emu Plains Cemetery. So Emu Plains used to be Emu Island, and well, they came across and they said it wasn't an island, let's call them Emu Plains. There used to be lots of emus, which are a large, I think they're intelligent birds. They definitely can run amok with your campsite or anything like that, sort of coming along, picking them up. They're pretty big, scary birds, emus, I think, if you encounter them in the wild. So that was Emu Plains. That's the tunnel, which is going to be the site of the mustard gas storage in World War II. And it was sort of ideal away from bombing. If you've got a large amount of mustard gas, you just want it away from enemy bombing. And you don't want it in a population centre, but you want it to be able to actually opt on a train. And so the train line goes all the way down, relatively close to the Naval Armoury. You can still go in the Naval Armoury around the Parramatta River. It's long since gone. But this is where all the boats with the Pacific War used to get armaments up. And of course, one of the things people don't realise is that the bombs and torpedoes have to be serviced every couple of months, in actual fact, or every year or so. And so you've got this constant rotation of armaments coming through, and it's actually quite a curious little thing. You get on a very small electric train, which takes you into the various buildings, which are all separated from each other, and you get these people. This is it's called the Armoury in Parramatta, and you go down there, and they talk about the different things. It's a museum now, and people had to be very quiet around the explosives, and all the boots had the military boots had different colours on them, so if you're in there, you could see if someone should be in there, because they'd be wearing yellow types of boots if they have to be in certain areas, and armourers had red toes on their boots, and they wouldn't actually speak because these explosives were so dreadful. So up around there, there's the British Armoury, and then the American Armoury, beautiful ammunition dumps, but the gas warfare unit was up here in high up in the mountains, or recently up the mountains. So if push came to shove, the various drums of mustard gas could be taken down to the armoury by train, so it's a safe distance away. And of course, they didn't tell the civilians around here. So Glenbrook had a little bit of a World War II stuff. There were professors and people like that, intelligentsia, who were living in the bush away, frightened of the Japanese. So there's occasional caves that you can find, which were occupied and built during World War II. People had gone bush to hide from the Japanese. Hi, mate. Little by little, the story after the war particularly came up. And there was a day that, when I first came to Glenbrook, the old people would say, look, I remember the day in Glenbrook. We were all told to go inside because there was a leak of mustard gas in Glenbrook, and police came around on their horses and said, you've all got to stay inside, everyone stay inside, keep quiet. And the only little thing, the local doctor came along, and occasionally he'd be treating these very suspicious blister burns on some of the soldiers up here. And what had happened, it turned out afterwards that a soldier was told to take some of the drums down the roads to Sydney. So he's told that if that barrel drops off the truck that you're going down, you'll be court-martialed. So he's be very careful. And so he got extra rope, and handling the extra rope, the drums had leaked a bit, and got it on his hands. So there's just some of the stories. There's a memorial for an aircraft which crashed up here in Glenbrook. So it was all happening here. And then at the end of the war, the mustard gas was taken to, I think, the armory, and poured out on the ground. And I think some other stuff was taken out and dumped at sea. Now, when that happened up in Germany, Germany had a large amount of mustard gas, and when it dumped it at sea, it was in the Baltic, and the Baltic's much colder water. And so what happened is that there was some sort of fishing fleet pulled up the drum of mustard gas. Many years afterwards, everyone died. But it's not because the mustard gas was preserved in the cold waters. There's a sort of very interesting book called, I think, The Gas War, written by experts to go and report on this many years after. It's a fantastic book, ripping reading to read through it, especially when it covers some of the local history, or sort of an official defence book, a defence study of it, looking at where the barrels were dropped and whether they'd be suffer a similar thing. But the waters of Australia, there's a strong current and the high temperature, the mustard gas, the barrels corrode much faster, and it's no longer a risk of that mustard gas. So there's of course, for me, there's a historical interest in this rather demonic chemical. And I think the British experimented with the mustard gas secretly and found out that it was absolutely pointless in the tropics, because of the high moisture, higher humidity meant that it really just stuck to it. And there's so much life in the tropics that it really didn't work. So if you'd shelled everything and shelled off all the wood and everything else like that in the battlefields of World War One, it had a different effect when it was cold. But when it's hot and humid, it was really pointless. And so I think more than anything else, it wasn't used in World War Two in the tropical regions, in the big Pacific War, partly because of it. At least that's what it was said in the book. So it is of interest, and for many, many, many years, there used to be it was still possible to go. You can go up to the tunnel under Glenbrook. I just actually walked past the old Glenbrook railway station, which is the now service station. And there's you walk in the bush and you suddenly see this tunnel. It's fantastic. And there used to be, for many years, a mushroom farm there. But inspections, which there are, I think it failed a work health and safety inspection. It didn't meet the modern standards of a modern whatever it is. After all, it was a mushroom farm, and people were bringing in, I suppose, horse, whatever it is, and growing mushrooms. But there's some aspects that it didn't meet the modern safety standards, and it was shut down, and in there there used to be people used to keep on seeing ghosts. So there's a couple of ghost stories around here, a ghost up here. There's also a series of ghost stories up about the local Air Command, so the Australian headquarters of the Royal Australian Air Force is sitting up here on the hill. And so there's all various stories about there. But surprisingly, it's all secured. The Army or the Air Force outsourced the security of its headquarters to private companies to look after it. There's still the police dog, so the Air Force dogs and stuff like that going around. So there's a lot of stories about it. And we come up to mustard gas, so it's something which has got a local story to it. And I think it was easily banned by the Geneva Convention. And at least in military-wise, we still study what's in the the Geneva Convention. So at the moment you might listen, I'm reading the Japanese version. It's hard to say, someone who's born in 63, why would they still be interested in it? It's just terrifying. Terrifying to look at it, and you could still see the set of mistakes these people were making is carried out here in Australia, in sort of humble institutions. People still lose their way, and you look at conflicts overseas and you just shake your head in disbelief compared to, you know, what were people thinking. So what I've read so far, the Japanese were just, I hope they were signatories to the Geneva Convention, but they were just doing all things like, it was just, well, that's wrong on that part. Oh, they can't do that on that. No, you can't do that. And but they were in that let's win. Oh, I suppose Pearl Harbor wasn't against the, would be against the Geneva Convention. Oh, I don't know. Yep. That being said, so let's go on to mustard gas. I realized I didn't have to speak so much. So. Let's go on to the ball and stick model. So mustard gas is relatively simple. It's got one sulfur, two chlorines, four carbons, and eight hydrogens. So it's a little gas, which is sort of pretty scary. So it's sulfur mustard gas. There's versions of this. Theoretically, you could make a nitrogen version of it, but the one used in warfare, developed by several Germans, is this sulfur one, and there's not much to it, but it actually does look like this bird, let's do the color of the ball filling models. So here we've got a difference. Previously we said black is carbon, white is white is hydrogen, red is oxygen, blue is nitrogen. There's no nitrogen and there's no oxygen in it, so we're going to introduce two other colors. So these are not the actual physical colors, these are the colors that you get out of your molecular chemical kit. You get sulfur, which is yellow, and chlorine, which is green. And it goes like this. It's a fairly simple molecule. And the thing which really grabs you, it looks a bit like a bird. I think it looks a bit like a bird, with the body being yellow and the ends of the wings being green. So it starts off that you have these two chloroethers. Chloroethanes attached to a sulfur, and that's the end of it. That's mustard gas. So that's why I was talking so long for it. But let's do the molecular tour. There's a linear molecule, and with linear molecules, I start at one end and go to the other. So you start with a chlorine. Chlorine can be bound onto a carbon. The carbon has four bonds, one to the chlorine, two hydrogens either side, and next to another carbon. That carbon, so that's the second carbon along, that second carbon is, that's uses up one bond, getting onto that second carbon along, two hydrogens either side of to bound, and then it binds onto a sulfur. The sulfur can bind to two things. It's like an oxygen in a ester or an ether. An oxygen can be in the chain, but it's only the oxygen. Nitrogen and amine in the chain can bind and have a spare hydrogen, but sulfur or oxygen are just in the chain. So a lot of the sulfurs, yeah, such a really thinking about the amino acid sulfurs, that's something I'll learn about. So once you're with that, so let's forget the hydrogen, so it goes chlorine, carbon, carbon, sulfur, and then it goes, it repeats again the opposite way symmetrically, two carbons, carbon, carbon, chlorine. So there's two chlorines there, and essentially, this is my memory going. Essentially, the mustard gas is something which doesn't get dissipated by water. So it hangs around as tiny droplets and it dissolves in fat. And where's fat? Skin. So it goes straight to the skin of any exposed skin or throat. So, well, I feel almost sick in talking about this. And then it goes and straight to the DNA and proteins, and there's this particular protein which it completely rips apart, which is ATGC guanine. I'm going to learn the nitrogenous bases, the four nitrogenous bases, and look, and they are, you know why I'm pretty obsessed with the multiple ring, the double rings of nitrogenous rings, hexagons and pentagons linked together. That fundamental molecule, I think I described the snowman at one stage. I really can't remember why I described it, but I really like these molecules because they haven't got all the mustard gas is sort of super flexible. It can rotate and oscillate and all that type of stuff. It's got the sulfur. It's got no hydrogen bonds on the outside, so it's, you can see it's not water soluble. So if it had an alcohol on it, oxygen, even if it had an oxygen sticking off, it would be a totally different animal. So it's really it really seeks out animals, animals which have fat. You know, trees have a bit of oil in them. I suppose eucalyptus have a bit of oil. The eucalyptus oil is a treat of a molecule. I still haven't quite worked out. There's turpentines and eucalyptus oils there, and what is it? Tetradioxins. These are molecules which are, I'm going to have to really work on how to describe them, because they're not chains. They are got flat bits in them, but they've also got molecules which, atoms which leap out of the page and connect one piece of your diagram to the other. They're sort of amazing molecules, but your mustard gas goes straight to the guanine. I've got the thing and absolutely wreaks havoc with them, and basically it just kills all your cells, all living cells, and of course the body reacts to that by blistering. It's sort of it's basically a life toxic thing, and as you hear, there was sort of two accidents with it in World War II. One, during the war, this poor soldier put his hands, I mean, you know, it'd be sympathetic to, but he put his hands on some ropes and just a tiny bit got on his hands. That was one thing. Well, of course, I think we would know accidents. They kept some good records. And another time, they poured out all the mustard gas on this hill. And you can actually walk on this hill today. And it was a particularly cold time in Sydney. And the mustard gas had actually gone underneath the soil. And this person walked on the frozen grass. And the mustard gas seeped into his boots. And so he was off his feet for a few weeks, I think. So that gives you an idea about just how toxic this is. Now, dare I say that in terms of chemical warfare area, there was the Union Carbide. So that's mustard gas. I'll just finish this off in that there's another pretty benign chemical, flat chemical, similar alike, which has a chlorite on it. So it's just your low grade hospital disinfectant. So it just splashes on the wall, basically kills everything by releasing that chlorite thing. That it's like as I've said, Mars is covered with things 10 times, 100,000 times more powerful disinfectant. So if you look up at Mars, I can see Jupiter at the moment. I can see Mars. That's no use for you, mate. But you can just see Mars and Jupiter on the ecliptic, just going up ahead. It's fairly easy to see them. But bear in mind, you can't see very much else besides those two planets at the moment. But this hospital disinfectant just completely destroys mustard gas. And so it's one of those things to sort of contemplate, that they could have just mixed it and just got rid of it. So this, and I will talk about this particular disinfectant. I can sort of see it, but I've only just had a look at it. And basically it's a toluene with a chlorite on the end of it, and so it's just a fairly benign thing that I was going to talk about. Oh yeah, well, this is Homebush, the Olympics. So Australia hosted the 2000 Olympics. It is relevant, and around there was just a whole heap of, you know, what are we going to do with this land? Because some of the land has a huge brick pick in it. So you walk out to the Olympic site and you have a walk, and there's this huge, like, I mean, very huge. It's like it's bigger than a skyscraper, but downwards. And you walk around it, and this is the old brick pit, old government brick pit. And they used to make all the bricks, and it wasn't commercially competitive with other brick picks. And so all the schools, all the government buildings are made out of these bricks from the brick pit. I think even up into the 70s they closed down. But besides that, there's the armament factory out there, and also Union Carbide. And Union Carbide used to make all the Agent Orange for use in Vietnam. Thank you very much. I suppose we didn't know much of it. And then they said, oh, you have to move out. You know, this is now going to be central Sydney to Union Carbide. And they said, by the way, where are all your chemical, where are you storing all the toxic chemicals? And they basically pointed to a place, which is now a mangrove swamp with a special dam on it going into Sydney Harbour. And the result of all the American Vietnam War Agent Orange production, and the barrels which were just thrown into the Parramatta River, means that the dioxin level from this Vietnam War level, I'm not joking, level, means that no one is allowed to eat fish from the Parramatta River before the Harbour Bridge. After the Harbour Bridge, the dioxin levels go down, but before the Sydney Harbour Bridge, upstream, due to these dioxin barrels, which they can't find, or they're just managing it, are still there. So that's poisoned all the water. So there's certain things. I believe there's no fishing license. So if you're upstream of where the Union Carbide factory, it's all okay. But that from the old Union Carbide factory all the way up to Sydney Harbour Bridge. Look, that's what I'm told. You're just hearing this in a podcast. Everything I've told you about the mass gas up here is true. Yeah, that's true. You can look it up yourself. It may be hard to find it on Wikipedia, but there are books, and it's well known and well documented. I've actually met people associated with it, and all the reports are reports about it. And so all that's true, and it's definitely true about the chemical toxins from the Union Carbide factory, meaning that we have this beautiful nature reserve with board planks about it, and it can no longer be developed, so it's a wildlife park. And it is true about the hill. The hill is a wildlife sanctuary up there, and they've got eagles. This is another thing you see around here is eagles. They've got the sea eagle nests, and they put a little camera up there, and you can go up to one of the old armament buildings, and inside it is a eagle preservation thing, and you can actually look in there, and there's a little camera up there, so you can actually see the eagles out there. I think I have heard that those eagles didn't survive too well. They were there thriving a couple of years ago, but I don't know how well they're doing at the moment. But you can definitely see eagles up here when they fly up around here, because every species of bird say it's on, and not sparrows or things, but you know, every bird of all the species band together and they start going up and attacking the eagle. It's quite an amazing thing to say. So that's where it's happening, and what I might do is a chemical tour of Agent Orange and have a look at it. There's some pretty vicious chemicals out there, and you just have to wander around it. And I just have to talk about it. So it's a very interesting aspect of it, and it's quite a sickening thing. Warfare in general, chemical warfare, is just insanely bad. Well, it obviously has to break a few things, but it's also indiscriminate and really unfair. But as far as chemical warfare has been used for, you know, since sort of irritation agents and poisons have been used since the beginning. But I do think warfare in general, well, this in Australia, we've banned guns. Like, there's no one who's, no one I know of owns a gun. And I haven't seen a gun. I haven't seen a gun. But for a couple of years, for at least 10, 15 years, I've never met anyone who owns a gun. There you go. And I'm saying that in terms of there's certain things that I think as a society, if we all agree to do without, it's much better off. So that's about mustard gas, and I hope that's been a useful molecular tool. I'll just go over the molecule again. It's chlorine, carbon, carbon, sulfur, carbon, carbon, chlorine. That's basically it. That's your mustard gas, and a pretty awful little beastie. Thanks a lot for listening. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.